Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Joanne Reeds managed to merge her business career with her passion for the arts. She started out as a recruiter at a minority executive recruitment firm, managing both its Cleveland and Pittsburgh offices before she joined Merrill Lynch as manager of its global human resources department. In 2002, she joined the board of the Romare Bearden Foundation, serving as primary fundraiser for 7 years, and in 2009 was named its co-director. The foundation was created in 1990 as a nonprofit organization aimed at preserving and perpetuating the legacy of this preeminent African-American artist, recognized as one of the most innovative in the 20th century. Bearden was not only a painter, but a cartoonist and a collagist. He was also a songwriter, co-writing the jazz classic Sea Breeze, and he was an author, writing several books. Born in North Carolina in 1911, Bearden died in New York City in 1988. And the Bearden Foundation can be found at www.beardenfoundation.org. So the Reed-Bearden match makes perfect sense. He made art, she makes sure it lives on. Joanne has organized art exhibitions and art auctions for years and has served on not-for-profit boards and philanthropy in the arts, including the West Virginia University Foundation, her alma mater. Joanne has also been on the receiving end of several honors, including the Black Achievers in Industry Award, the Hall of Fame Award for the National Association of Negro Business and Professional Women, and Special Recognition Award for her fundraising efforts on behalf of the United Negro College Fund and the National Association for Equal Opportunity in Higher Education. Joanne, welcome, and thanks for joining me today.
Thanks very much for having me.
So take us on your love affair with fine arts and music. When did it begin?
Well, I actually think it began when I was a child. I grew up in a very rural environment. My father was a coal miner. And
so you grew up in West Virginia?
I grew up in West Virginia. That was home.
Mm-hmm.
It felt a little like a Leave It to Beaver lifestyle, because when you don't know what you don't know, you don't know. And so we were having what I thought was a marvelous life. My father was a craftsperson. He made lots of things. In fact, he made me my very first radio.
Oh my gosh.
He was studying electronics at home, one of those at home courses.
Uh-huh.
And so it could only get one channel, but one station, but hey, it played a little music, and I still have it. I honored it and treasured it, and it was
So this was his hobby.
This was a hobby. He was actually planning on relocating the family from West Virginia, and that was going to be his new career. But unfortunately, he didn't make it. He was killed when I was 13. He was in a tragic coal mining accident.
Oh, dear.
And so that left 4 kids and my mom to try and survive in a little rural town, which was quite an interesting journey.
Considering that obviously the main profession there was coal.
That was what everyone did.
So where did the fine arts or art and music come in for you?
Well, we didn't have art education in school. We didn't have anything of that nature. We did have a music class, but that was it. And so as I went away to college, my freshman year in college, that was when I began to get my exposure to art, to African-American literature, all of the things that I hadn't been exposed to as a child. And I just began self-study, gobbling mm-hmm. up as much information as I could, reading as many books as I could, attending as many exhibitions and shows as I could. And I could tell then that I just had a love for it. I didn't know enough about it to really do anything with it, but I just wanted to see and learn as much as I possibly could.
Because clearly, in the town that you grew up in, there were just not options like that. There probably were no museums. I'm guessing that either you had to create your own little worlds or your own fantasies, as opposed to, well, unless you were exposed to books and go to the library and kind of transcend yourself.
That is exactly right. There were no museums. There was one little historical museum that gave you some information on the state of West Virginia, but that was it. And at college, we had very limited art, but we did have theater. And so, therefore, we would begin to get a little bit involvement in that. And then I was in school during the time of the Black Panther Party.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, there was all the artwork that came out around that, the photographs, the drawings, the posters.
But that was really political.
That was political, but it was still art.
It's still art. You're right.
It was still art.
Mm-hmm.
And I think art in many ways is can very oftentimes be very political.
So you were a blank canvas, stating the obvious, ready and willing to absorb what you were newly exposed to.
Exactly. I always refer to myself as being like a sponge. I mean, I was just absorbing everything that I could get my hands on. And it's the way I learn. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I like to immerse myself in things, and it's how I learn about things.
You found all this on your own, or was there somebody instrumental in exposing this to you and for you?
Later in my life, when I moved to New York and when I started working at Merrill Lynch, there was a person who really helped me to really crystallize my love for art, and that was a gentleman by the name of Russell Goings. He was a friend of Bearden and is a big collector of art, and he was the person that actually introduced me to Romare Bearden. I had a chance to meet him before he passed away.
I was going to ask you that.
And, you know, I spent a whole afternoon with him. I was in his studio. He was working on work that was going to be exhibited in a couple of weeks, and he would actually take the piece and explain it to me and show me. I mean, there's no way in that would have ever happened. I mean, that was...
Wow.
It was an experience that I will always remember. And he took me to lunch, and while we were lunching, he said to me, "Well, do you collect art?" I didn't collect.
Of course not.
I said, "Well, no." And he said, "Well, I see you collect shoes," because I had on some crazy shoes. And he said, "In life, you want to collect something that's going to have value and meaning, and something that's going to last." And he gifted me with the first piece of artwork that I ever owned.
Isn't that amazing?
An image that he had created. It was a lithograph. He personalized it. That set me on a mission. And from there, I started working with, in my spare time, the Women's Center, which was a facility that was there to help battered women. And the problem that they had was they needed money so that they could continue to provide the services that they provided. And so I said, "Well, why don't we do some art sales? Let's see if we can do some art sales as a way of making money for the organization." And so I began to call artists and have conversations
cold
with them.
Cold calling them?
Didn't know them. Cold called them. I said, "Listen, I'm with this organization. We want to try and do some art sales." And I said, we will do a split with you. Would you mind? And they said, "Sure."
Hold on. What year was this?
Oh, gosh. This would have been back in the early 80s.
Early 80s.
In the early 80s.
So you had a lot of chutzpah.
I did. Mm-hmm. Always have. No way you get out of West Virginia without a lot of chutzpah.
Just as an aside, have you ever been back?
I go back from time to time. I still have some family that's there. Mm-hmm. It's not a place that you would... It's really not a place that I would see myself growing and developing further.
Did you know when you were attending West Virginia University that you were getting out?
I always knew that I was getting out. There was little opportunity. I would have been working for some type of manufacturing facility, making glass bottles or lamps, light bulbs.
Mm-hmm.
Not something I wanted to do in life.
But what you majored, I read, in psychology.
Yes.
At school, thinking that you were going to do what?
Thinking that I was going to become a clinical psychologist. And then I learned that over time, I didn't want to delve that deep into people's problems because they were more than I thought that over time I'd be able to handle. And while working at Merrill, it was interesting. I had the medical department at one point in time reported into me, and there was a psychologist that worked there. And she really gave me a great understanding of what I had sort of like a little bit of foresight in before it actually happened to me, that, you know, after a while you take on all of those things and it starts to trouble you. Mm-hmm. And then you find that you need your own counseling.
No kidding.
So I was happy that I didn't go that way.
I can't imagine the shock you must have experienced from moving from rural West Virginia to New York City. Why did you do that?
Well, I was married at the time.
Okay.
And my spouse was playing professional soccer, and he's from Jamaica. And it was his home where he wanted to come back to, and that's what brought me to New York. I can tell you that the first few years here was like, what have I done?
I bet.
It was crazy. I was trying to take the subway in high heel shoes. you know, being a person that's really concerned with my feet, that was really a problem. I mean, just adjusting to everything, the trash on the street, the crowded conditions.
There's no place like it. I can't imagine the culture shock you must have experienced.
But, you know, I've come to love it. Now I don't want to be anywhere else.
I bet.
But at that initially, the shock was tremendous.
Was it difficult for you to get work as a woman and as an African-American woman?
You know, I don't know. I think I was kind of lucky. I went on an interview. This was one of these like career days. And I met a person and they said, well, who are you? Who did you work with? And I said, well, I used to work with this organization known as RAND Associates. And just so happened they knew them. And they said, oh, we got a job. And so I went in, I interviewed. They hired me the same day. I mean, that was unheard of. And at that time, they paid me a salary that I thought was unheard of because I wasn't making that kind of money.
Well, where did you come from when you worked for RAND Associates?
Cleveland, Ohio.
Okay.
I was living in Cleveland, Ohio. And at that time, I think, gosh, you know, you're making around $8,000 to $10,000 a year. I came to New York, first job, $22,000 a year.
Wow, you tripled your salary.
It was like huge.
Almost, yeah.
You know, you triple your work, you triple everything that you're doing. So,
and of course, your rent is tripled and everything else.
Your expenses are outrageous.
Exactly.
But you, you know, you learn. You learn a lot.
And so between adjusting to New York and adjusting to work in New York, you get exposed to the arts, like you say, from this gentleman, and you meet Romare Bearden.
Exactly.
And so how, we're sort of jumping around, but that's all right. How did it work out with that particular auction to help fund this women's center? Was it successful?
They were very successful. We did them often.
But after the first one under your belt?
After the first one, we were just on a roll. And artists would actually approach us and say, hey, you know, we understand that you're doing this and we'd like to help. And, you know, at the time, I didn't have a real understanding of, you know, beginning artists or mid-career artists or artists at the senior level, but we had artists coming from all areas. And I had met a friend from California who was an artist. He was a photographer, had been a photographer for many years for Ebony Magazine. And he was showing his work on the Cosby Show, the Amen Show, you know, getting some exposure. And he came in and did a show for us. And it was just great.
So as you get more of these under your belt, what's going on in your head here about, you know, marrying this with the work that you were doing in business?
Well, you know, initially I always kind of kept the two of them like two separate
trails. Avocation and a vocation.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I worked, you know, because the job was very demanding. You know,
at Merrill Lynch.
You were spending 70 hours a week. You know, I was there during Black Friday when, you know, the horrible thing happened and we had to downsize thousands of people in a very short period of time. I had to manage that effort. I would work on the work at the office, but it was the love of the art that was like the...
Your sustenance, what kept you going, huh?
Like the breath of fresh air that sometimes I needed when I'd spent a heck of a week. And I, at one point, thought, well, you know, maybe at some point in life I might do something with this. I might
full time.
But right at that point, I was just working that job. I was, you know, on that treadmill and I was doing what was necessary. And
why did you join the board of the Bearden Foundation? What was the catalyst?
A person called me up, asked me if I would like to become a member of the board of the Romare Bearden Foundation.
Which means what? What did that entail?
It basically means fundraising.
Ugh, yeah,
that's
I
what
know.
The deal is. They want you to raise money. Mm. Because they need money to survive and they want you to raise money. So initially I didn't understand that because I hadn't served on that many boards yet. But I thought, okay. And I went in and I met them and I met all of the other people that were there. And
there was a director, obviously, at that time of the Bearden Foundation.
Yes.
Because, as I said, that was formed in 1990,
right.
And this was 12 years later.
Right.
So it was fairly well established.
Fairly well established, yes.
You had met Bearden, like you said, in the late 80s, so you
right.
have this under your belt.
Right.
And now you're getting really turned on to this, huh?
I'm getting really turned on to it. And so when I came on the board, the first thing that they said, well, we, you know, we need somebody to help us do fundraising. And I raised my hand and I said, oh, yeah.
I know this.
I'll do that. And so we started out by doing galas, you know, we did galas and, you know, we would honor someone and we would bring them in. It was a big party. It was lovely. And we would have a auction as a part, one of the components that was there. And I knew a lot of artists, so I was able to bring them in. And other people at the foundation knew artists, so it was just growing and growing. And we were successful. I did that for a number of years as a board member, helping to raise funds for the foundation.
And what else does the Romare Bearden Foundation?
The foundation is really designed to perpetuate his legacy.
Mm-hmm.
We house his art. We house his archives. We house his library. We're responsible for his copyright. And we run programs. We have a teaching artist program for kids, which was designed by Bearden. And we offer that program in schools across New York City.
Mm-hmm.
We run a program for artists in their mid-careers, so that we can aid them and help them so that they can grow and develop.
Monetarily?
Well, not monetarily. It's more informational.
Okay.
The only real monetary program that we have is we fund scholarships. We do fund some scholarships for students at certain schools.
Art schools.
Mm-hmm.
And what is it about his art that spoke to you, attracted you?
I think what attracted me was the fact that he took so many separate component parts and put them together and created a whole. So his collage work, for me, if you see it, you know, you have a big eye, a big hand, a crooked hand. It's all so many different components.
Mm-hmm.
And yet when you pull it all together, it gives you an expression, an emotional expression of what that person was feeling at the time that he created that work.
Do you think that not enough people know who he is, was?
I think that some people know who he was, but it's a everyday job. I mean, that's what we do all the time. We are constantly trying to make people understand who he was. And, you know, he was a very fair-complected man. He looks like a white man.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been at exhibits that we have had across the country, and people would say, well, why do so many black people come out to see this person's work? They don't know. And so you have to educate them and explain, this is an African-American man. He wasn't a white man.
How did it wind up that you became the co-director?
It was opportunity meets opportunity.
So you were ready to leave the business
world?
Well,
I had actually left Merrill Lynch.
Okay.
I left Merrill Lynch in 2000, I think. I got to remember that date. But yeah, I think it was 2000. I left because I was managing the human resources effort on an international basis. So I was traveling a lot, Hong Kong, Tokyo, Singapore, all over. And I developed an illness. I came down with sarcoidosis.
Which is what?
It's an immune deficiency that, in my case, affected my breathing and my lungs.
Wow.
And it can affect any organ in your body. But in my case, it affected my breathing. So the travel
wasn't working out.
Couldn't do it. And so even though the firm said that I could do other things, I just felt like I was ready.
Done. Mm-hmm.
I was ready.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took a little time off, and my mom was living with me at the time, and I was able to spend some time with her. And I did that for a while, and then that's when the opportunity at the foundation presented itself.
That the co-director was leaving, and they looked at you.
It was one director.
Uh-huh.
She was leaving to take a job at another firm. So that at that time, they just had a job that was called executive director.
Of the foundation.
Of the foundation. And she left, and there was one other person internally that they wanted to give a part of the job to, and then they asked me if I would take the other part.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we created the co-director role.
How many paid employees does the foundation have?
Right now, we only have three paid employees.
Wow.
We're very small.
But in spite of that size, of staff size, you do an inordinate amount of work.
We have traveling exhibitions, which are across the country. That's been a wonderful experience because you get a chance to visit all these museums and
mm-hmm.
you get a chance to know the museum directors, etc. We have the programs that we're offering. We work with teaching artists, so they come on board and they work for us on a part-time basis to deliver the courses that we're doing, or consultants that will come on board if we're going to plan a big event, you know, a gala or something of that nature. We have volunteers that work with us as well. We work with the St. Louis Art Museum. They have a Romare Bearden Fellow that comes and does training with us every year. So we can find enough hands to help us get done what we need to do.
Let's talk about African-American artists.
Okay.
Kerry James Marshall,
yes,
who has an exhibit of his work at the Breuer Museum in New York City. I went twice because
it's
I was so blown away by the art that focuses portraits of African-American men, women, and children. They're not ubiquitous in art, and this man almost single-handedly is trying to change that landscape, even though he just didn't start painting 10 minutes ago.
No, he's been painting a long time.
So talk to me about that.
Well, I mean, I think there are a lot of African-American artists, but they don't receive the same level of recognition that white artists do.
Because?
Because we live in America.
Yeah.
And
I know that was a foolish question, but
there is, you know, it can be heartbreaking in some ways because you can see some work that is so incredible, but only you and a few other people may be seeing it because they don't get the exposure where they're going to be at the Met or MoMA or some of these other major museums across the country. I mean, it's rare that you see African Americans having large major exhibitions. Kerry James Marshall is
an exception.
He's fortunate too because he's alive while it's happening.
Yes.
Bearden, he was the first African American to be exhibited at the National Gallery, and that was recent. I mean, it wasn't that
even many, in his lifetime.
Even in his lifetime.
Did he know his success when he was alive?
I think he knew some, yes, I'm sure he did, but I think that he also knew that he possessed something that was far greater and that should have a broader reach. So he constantly worked to make sure that happened.
What do you mean
and
by that?
And he painted constantly. He was always working.
Mm-hmm.
He was always working. And he was having exhibits at the Courtier Ekstrom Gallery, I believe is the gallery he was working with before he passed away.
In New York City?
In New York City.
Mm-hmm.
He was an advocate, so he was always pushing for African American artists. I mean, if he saw something that was happening that he didn't feel was right, he would voice an opinion. He was also a collaborator. He would try and pull together other artists to work together because he knew that united, you were going to be in a better state than you were trying to fight alone. I mean, it's a constant struggle for artists to find that light that will let their work be seen by as many people as possible.
I was hoping that the exhibit of Kerry James Marshall at the Breuer Museum, which is former Whitney, now owned by the Met, that a lot of school children would be exposed to this. You know, because here I am, as a much older person, I never heard of this guy, Kerry James Marshall. And I saw the exhibit twice because I was so blown away by his work.
Right. You know, we do similar things with Bearden. We do symposiums where we bring in scholars who actually write articles and information. They do new research so that more information on an artist can be known. Right now, we're working on a catalog resume for Romare Bearden. He died in 1988, and he doesn't have a catalog resume.
What does that mean?
A catalog resume is where your work is collected, identified,
documented.
Exactly.
In a book. That's what I was going to ask you about. The foundation houses a permanent collection. Is that most of his work?
It's not most of his work, because most of his work has been sold.
I was going to ask that also.
It's owned by museums, galleries, or, you know, personal collectors.
Mm-hmm.
Most of his work has been sold, but we do have a collection. And then the estate of his wife's estate has a collection of his work, too. But we do have his archives and his books. So his archives are doodle books where he would draw or take notes or things of that nature.
Do you believe that Bearden lived to see his success?
Yes, I think he lived to see some of his success. Yes, yes, I do believe he did.
What have you done, and brag about this, at the reins of the foundation? How has it changed? How has it gotten better, bigger, whatever, since you took over in 2009?
Working with my co-director, Deidre Harris-Kelly, we are sort of like partners in crime, if you think of it in that way. We work diligently to put on events that are going to continue to give him the biggest and best exposure that he can get. I think one of the things that I was really proud of is that we were able to get Macy's to partner with us, and we did a Macy's Bearden celebration. We went to all of their major sites across the country, and I believe there were 11 major sites, and at each of those sites, We did an exhibition of his work.
In the stores?
In the stores. We did a display of his children's books, that because he's created children's books. We had a display of that. We had artists that came in. He created a cookbook. We had a chef that came in that created recipes that were taken from his book. There was dance, because he loved music and he loved dance. His wife promoted dance. His sister-in-law was a dancer, and he created poetry and costumes for dance. And we were able to put that across the country in 11 major cities. We borrowed works from collectors. I would say that they had maybe 25, 30 pieces at each show. That would give people a chance to see his work and be exposed. They ran a national ad campaign featuring information on him.
And you were you gave birth to this.
That was
what year was that?
Baby.
Do you remember?
Oh, gosh. I don't remember.
What's happening now with you and the foundation?
Right now, we're working on the catalog resume. That's a research phase, because we have to gather all of the material. We have to make sure everything is accurate. We have to gather the images. And then we work together with a book company to put it together. So we're spending a lot of time working on that.
It's astonishing, because you don't use this term cavalierly, but he really was a Renaissance man.
He was a Renaissance man. There's no question about it.
And does he have children?
He had no children. He was married, and he and his wife had no children at all. So when he passed away, his wife came from a large family, and so she lived beyond him, and so she became the person that helped to establish his foundation and
perpetuate his legacy.
Get everything set up. He had proposed it in his will that he wanted to have a foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And when he passed away, she did exactly what he asked her to do.
What, if any, works of Bearden's do you own? Have?
Well, I have, of course, the piece that he gifted me.
All those years ago,
yes.
Which I am sure is so special
it
to
is.
You.
It is. It's very, very special. And then I purchased a piece, which is a piece that's called Falling Star. And, you know, Bearden was honored with being put on a postage stamp, and they chose four of his images, which they put on the stamps. And Falling Star, which is the image that I purchased, is one of the four images that was placed.
Was that a painting?
This is a lithograph. This was a lithograph. I have a watercolor of his, but I don't have a collage of his, and that's something that I would like to be able to get my hands on at some point.
His collages really resonated with so many people.
Right.
They were just amazing.
Yes.
So where are you today? We're just about out of time. I know it goes fast, doesn't it?
It does.
Tell me about you today and what's happening with Bearden and some of you. And you do other exhibits on the side?
I do other exhibits on the side. There are other artists whose work I like to
promote,
yeah. I'm promoting an artist by the name of Valerie Maynard. She's a 78-year-old artist that lives in Baltimore, Maryland. She was a sculptor, and if you happen to ever visit the 4th and 5th subway line at 125th Street
in New York City,
she created the artwork that's there, that's on display.
78,
there.
Huh? Yeah. And still going strong.
Still going strong. I'm always active in my community, trying to be involved. I feel fortunate to have been able to walk this journey. I feel fortunate to have been able to meet the people that I've met. You know, I work with my nephew a lot, Clinton Daniel, in terms of promoting his music. And, you know, I just feel fortunate that so far my life has been good, and I'm very excited about what's going to come.
Well, that's a great segue, because I feel really fortunate to have had this conversation with you, and people will be really fortunate when they listen in and hear all about you and Romare Bearden, and we owe you a lot for bringing art to the masses.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women, and please go to our iTunes store page and leave a rating and a review. And if you know anyone you think that we should interview, contact us at sandyclineshow.com. Celebration of the joy.